We get occasional blow-ups, okay, constant blow-ups over immigration in our country, and refugees often end up at the center of those blow-ups. Such was the case after the Vietnam War when Vietnamese refugees arrived in the United States. On the Texas Gulf Coast, Vietnamese people trying to make a living fishing ran up against white people who were already doing that with predictable tensions. Kirk Wallace Johnson tells the story of the tensions and the pollution quietly killing the fishery they were fighting over in The Fisherman and the Dragon, Fear, Greed, and a Fight for Justice on the Gulf Coast. Kirk Wallace Johnson has had his writing widely published in the likes of the LA Times and the New Yorker. He is the founder of the List Project to resettle Iraqi allies. His previous book, The Feather Thief, brought him to the Jefferson Exchange in 2018, and we played that again last fall. Kirk Wallace Johnson, welcome back to the Jefferson Exchange.
Oh, it's a thrill to be back.
It is good to have you. So the story is about fishing boats and refugees and racists opposing them. It's not a story I had much of a memory of. Is it not a story well known away from the Gulf Coast?
No, I've been a little surprised at how this seems to have evaded public consciousness over all these decades. In fact, there's a lot of Texans that have no idea that this happened, although it's been kind of hiding in plain sight to such a degree that, I mean, Bruce Springsteen wrote a song about all of this in 1996 called Galveston Bay, and even still, nobody seems to know about it.
Wow. And lest anyone think this is some cute morality play with, you know, heroes and villains and all that stuff clearly cut, you offer a picture on page 2 of the Ku Klux Klan on a boat. This got serious, deadly serious.
Yeah. I mean, this is a story that even now, after having spent several years investigating it, I still sometimes can't believe that it happened the way that it did. But I mean, it's an astonishing clash between Vietnamese refugees who essentially washed ashore in the United States. They didn't want to come here. They lost their country, though, and in trying to rebuild their lives here, many of them had been shrimpers and crabbers back home, and so they moved to the Texas coast. And at first, the white fishermen were delighted to have them because they unloaded all of these, you know, clunkers of decrepit boats on the refugees, often at 10 times the true value. But the Vietnamese fixed them up. They used their family members as deckhands. They ate what white people consider to be junk fish to cut down on costs. And within a few years, they were so effective at this, this is by the late 1970s now, that the white fishermen freaked out and they ran to the Texas governor and they begged for a ban on refugees. And when that failed, the Klan entered the fight. I should say it was a one-sided fight here. And Vietnamese trawlers were torched to the waterline. Vietnamese homes were firebombed. You have to imagine 1981, the Klan was running Klan boat patrols throughout Galveston Bay, where heavily armed and robed Klansmen were marauding the bay, searching for Vietnamese to harass. So this is if this all sounds crazy and impossible, I mean, that was my feeling at the beginning until I started meeting nearly everybody face to face. That was at the heart of this story.
Yeah, there is a real sense of what as you turn the pages in the book, and one person died, Billy Joe Applin. We learned about early in the book. I mean, how, and were there others?
Yeah. So the story of Billy Joe Applin is a really crucial one to understand all of this. So he was not a native Texan, but he had become a crabber in this tiny town of Seadrift. And, you know, he kept pulling up these crabs that were mutated and had misshapen shells, and he suspected the petrochemical industry, these huge plants lining all the coastline there, as being responsible for the diminished catch and these strange things that fishermen were seeing in the waters. But he couldn't rally anyone behind him to take on these plants. Every one of these fishermen, or nearly all of them, have family members that work at the plants, or they have jobs there in the off season. And so he's in a frustrated place because he's trying to, you know, eke out a living, but his traps are coming up light. And then in the midst of all of this, the Vietnamese start being resettled to Texas. And after he had a kind of run-in with an 18-year-old Vietnamese crabber named Sao Van Nguyen, something just, you know, switched in his mind. He didn't care. He wasn't focused on the plants anymore. He was just out to get this young Vietnamese man, and he was, over the subsequent month, he was, you know, giving him death threats and raising a rifle at him and slashing his tires, and Sal eventually got himself a pistol because he was worried about his own safety. And sure enough, a couple weeks later, Billy Joe was assaulting him down by the docks, drew a knife and cut Sal across the chest, and Sal pulled out his gun and shot Billy Joe dead. And kind of to the surprise of everyone, Sal, who turned himself in, was acquitted by an all-white jury who understood that he had killed Billy Joe lawfully on grounds of self-defense. And so while that acquittal might be inspiring for some, it turned Billy Joe Applin into something of a martyr on this coastline, but it also then immediately led to the Ku Klux Klan coming in. And for decades, people always wondered, why did the Klan care so much about the fate of this crabber in a small town? And it wasn't until I was sitting across from his widow that I'm able to finally answer it, which was that Billy Joe himself had joined the Klan about a year or so prior to his killing.
I want to get a name established here and come back to her later, and that's Diane Wilson, who also fished for a living, not hugely successfully. How rare, first of all, was it for a woman to get in that business, and what things was she discovering besides her luck at fishing?
Diane Wilson was a fourth-generation shrimper, but to my knowledge, she's the first female shrimper, certainly in Seadrift, if not the broader Texas Gulf Coast. And, you know, it's a hard way of life. I mean, when she was crabbing, she was going out every morning to run her traps. And I think she was making something like $4,000 or $5,000 a year throughout the 70s and early 80s. But she, like many of these shrimpers and crabbers, every now and then would pull up something mutated in her nets or her traps, some odd shape and shrimp or crab. But she also was working at a fish house where people would bring in the daily catch, and, you know, fishermen would come in and tell her about these strange things, like alligators rolling near the surface of the water, kind of like zombies, and you know, she saw big die-offs of dolphins in the bays. And she didn't understand why, but she suspected the plants, and she started keeping a kind of an inventory of these mutated specimens in the back of her freezer, where she would tag the date and the location. And she didn't really have much of a plan for doing so. She just had a hunch, and it ended up becoming a decades-long battle against the petrochemical industry to try to save these bays. She's a really extraordinary individual.
Truly, and it's a major story here that underlies the rest of it. The fact is that you got the Klan fighting with the Vietnamese refugees over a fishery that is already severely damaged by pollution. We'll come back to that, but let's talk about the Klan angle a bit again here, because we talked about the Klan coming in and Billy Joe Applin, who was ended up being killed in fights over the fishing. Had joined the Klan himself about a year before his death, but this brings in Louis Beam, and we need to talk about him because he casts a long shadow in space and in time.
That's right. Yeah, I mean, Louis Beam is a pretty odious character in U.S. history. He was already pretty radicalized racist before his deployment to Vietnam as a door gunner. He returned from that war highly decorated, but came back and quickly became the Grand Dragon of the Texas Knights of the Ku Klux Klan. He had a pretty astonishing list of indictments, charges of, you know, blowing up radio stations, and, you know, he tried to attack the vice premier of China, Deng Xiaoping. But it wasn't until the death of Billy Joe Applin that I think Louis Beam realized what an opportunity this was to stir things up along that coastline and to get media attention, which, you know, when after Sal was acquitted, the young man who killed Billy Joe that I was speaking about, Louis Beam decides on his own that he's going to do a fact-finding Klan mission down to this little town of Seadrift to figure out what went wrong in this trial. And it's an astonishing turn of events because this town of 1,000 people, the entire town met in the school gymnasium to have a debate, and they unanimously passed a resolution condemning the Klan and telling them to basically buzz off, don't come. But Beam, the Grand Dragon, comes down anyways with a, you know, ragtag group of a few Klansmen, and he finds a bank of national TV news, including, I think, Cronkite was covering it. And shortly after he makes his speeches and gets all of this national publicity, he gets a bunch of new dues-paying members. He opens up a new Klan chapter in that town. And I think this kind of sets the model for him, where he's, you know, he's going to whip this stuff up whenever he can. So a year or so later, up in Galveston Bay, when tensions were at a fever pitch, he, you know, basically came in with a flamethrower and you know, was giving these public rallies in front of 1,000 people chanting white power, where he was giving the refugees 90 days to get out or else face blood, blood, blood. He's a terrifying individual. I'm sure he would love, you know, be bursting with pride to be seen as terrifying. But he, you know, after all of this, after the events of my book, he, you know, he fled to the Aryan Nations compound in Idaho, where he wrote the book and the essays that basically inspired a whole generation of lone wolf white supremacist terrorists.
And he's quite explicit, you know. He says things like, it's our country or nobody's.
That's right. And, you know, they're, back then he's talking all about, you know, the problems at the border. And when I was reading I read more white supremacist literature than I ever would wish on anyone. But you look at these newsletters from back then, from like 1981, where they're writing about the evils of Vietnamese refugees and shrimpers. And right next to it, there's a big article about the need to build the American Wall, with schematics about where to dig the moat and how to electrify it so that people won't cross the border. So, you know, these aren't novel ideas. He just, you know, he was very effective at whipping people up. And I mean, he's now considered the godfather of the alt-right and the extreme right wing.
Indeed. We're talking to Kirk Wallace Johnson about his latest book out in August, The Fisherman and the Dragon, Fear, Greed, and a Fight for Justice on the Gulf Coast. You're more than welcome to join the conversation. 800-838-3760 on the phone. Email is jx@jeffnet.org. So we've got the KKK in Seadrift. We've also got efforts by various levels of government to try to make peace there. Let's talk about that, the governor of Texas, the Department of Justice.
Yeah, I mean, you know, after that killing, both the state and the federal government realized that this problem was likely to persist. And so they sent mediators from the Justice Department to all of these little fishing towns to try to broker some kind of, you know, gentleman's agreement between the whites and the Vietnamese. Now, I should say that the Vietnamese were not going out menacing the whites. They were just, early on, they were, their biggest sin was that they were violating the quote-unquote unwritten rules of the bay. So they, when they got here, they didn't know some of the norms about, you know,
where to place your rigs and things like that.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. And so, but they were learning, they were committed to improving. But along the coastline, the Justice Department kept bringing these groups together, and they would, you know, sign their names to these non-binding documents to say, okay, we'll leave you guys alone if you start doing this better or that better. But it really, you know, it was a, these efforts really needed time for trust to build and for a track record to be established. And there was just nothing that they could do against this group of whites and their Klan allies that were just committed to kind of blowing it all up.
Well, and so this is obviously part of a larger Klan resurgence in the 1980s, which kind of triggered my memory. I'd forgotten that my partner, when I was working at a station in Alabama in 1982, had gone out to cover some news conference held by the Klan. So, yes, it was definitely afoot at that time. Enter now Morris Dees of the Southern Poverty Law Center. He got in the middle of this, too.
Yes, that's right. You know, Morris is a fascinating guy. I mean, he grew up in a, you know, humble circumstances. He had a bunch of Klansmen in his extended family. And he, you know, was born outside of Montgomery and basically was a teenager and college student as the civil rights movement was being born. He was a freshman in his first week on campus when Authorine Lucy was admitted, and she was the first to integrate that school, and he watched as a mob, you know, chucked bricks and eggs at her. But he basically sat out the whole civil rights movement. Even though he had a law degree, he was just focused on getting rich, which he did. By the age of 30, he was a multi-millionaire. He was a cookbook salesman and a bunch of other things. And I think, I don't know, some element of, you know, penance or expiation, I don't know, but he decided he was going to put his law degree to work and start helping out. And so that's when he founded the Southern Poverty Law Center. And this Klan case, where he came in to help the Vietnamese refugees, that was the center's only second Klan case. But he saw a photo of that Klan boat patrol on Galveston Bay one morning in the New York Times, hopped on his motorcycle and sped down there and basically worked with the Vietnamese to defend themselves, not with weapons, but by putting their trust in the Constitution that it would protect them against this kind of harassment.
And boy, talk about a face-off here. Now, Morris Dees deposed Louis Beam in person?
Yes. Yeah, I was in quite a, you know, when I finally found all of the transcripts from these depositions and from the court case, you know, it's, your eyes kind of bulge when you read through them because you've, you know, in the first deposition of Louis Beam, I think it lasted only a few minutes before Morris, who is sitting next to a very charismatic Colonel Nam Van Nguyen, who was sort of representing the Vietnamese, the colonel leans over and whispers to Morris that the Grand Dragon, Louis Beam, is hiding a pistol under his Klan robe in the deposition room. And Morris kind of freaks out, and they make a plan, all of them, that he's going to confront Louis, and if he jumps up with a weapon, they're going to all try to jam this conference table against the Grand Dragon and pin him against the wall so that they might have a chance to escape. This is not the stuff of normal deposition.
That's what I'm thinking. Yeah, they're rather dry affairs, but this was not.
Yeah, and so they confront him. Beam, I think, senses that he's caught, and he bolts from the room. But then the rest of this crazy court case was marked by this threat of violence, where other lawyers were coming back and finding Klansmen parked out front, leaving little threatening calling cards, and they're wedged in their front door. There was worry about bombs being planted under the lawyers' cars. So there were, and then immediately after the judge issued her ruling, she was the first black judge appointed to the federal bench. She's an incredible woman, Judge Gabrielle McDonald. She received all kinds of horrific, you know, racist, threatening stuff sent to her in her own chambers. So this was a situation where the wheels of justice turned, but there were plenty of people hacking at them and trying to keep them from doing so.
Indeed. So let's move ahead in time to another lawsuit, picking up the thread of all the environmental damage on that part of the Gulf Coast. I mean, what besides the onshore petrochemical plants were contributing to the problems with the fishery and the mutant things that were turning up in the water?
Yeah. So you know, it really there was some moment of revelation while I was doing the research for this book, where I was focused so much on the fact that this was a turf war, but I wasn't really paying much attention to the turf itself. And, you know, it's shocking to me, but this is, I mean, this part of the country, this Texas coastline, has some of the most toxic water in the country. It's colloquially known as the cancer belt. People there have something like 160 times the cancer rate the rest of the country. And it's because, I mean, we, you know, oil was discovered in Texas, and as a result, all of these huge refineries and chemical plants started metastasizing along the coast. But along the way, we were pouring concrete over all the estuaries for highways and for hotels and vacation homes. Each one of these new plants would get, you know, tax abatements and all of these things from the state, but they would also get fresh water that was impounded from the rivers that was supposed to tumble into those bays, but would first pass through the plant and then be discharged along with the toxic, you know, slurry. And so, you know, in some ways this was, and you factor in climate change as well, where there was so much increased rainfall that the salinity levels were changing and making it less hospitable for shrimp and crabs. And I realized that this was a story where, you know, it's tough to say this, but that this was a way of life that worked for hundreds of years, but that was essentially doomed by the sort of sometimes ugly progress, in quotes, of mankind. And yet, the whites who had traditionally held sway over this, they didn't look at all of these big structural societal forces that was killing these bays. They just pointed a finger at this tiny number of refugees, and they said, let's get rid of them, and everything will be great again. There was one woman, Diane, that we spoke about. She seemed to be the only one who could properly diagnose the threat, to say, stop debasing yourself with this racist fight against the refugees and start taking on these plants, which are not only destroying the bays, but they're destroying our bodies. I mean, I got to the point where I could tell who worked at which plant by the type of cancer that they had.
Oh, wow. So what finally brought Diane Wilson to sue somebody over the pollution?
What's that?
I mean, it was decades later. What finally got Diane Wilson to file a suit?
Well, she had been building this collection of mutations without really having a game plan. And then one day in 1989, she's reading the newspaper, and there's the results of the first ever toxic release inventory, which Congress mandated that these industries report just how much they were polluting. And as she's reading, and she has five children at this point, she reads that her county, you know, which had 20,000 people in it, was the most polluted county in America. That not just even the bays, the soil, the air, the water coming through the faucets, and she balled up the paper in a fit of rage and just set out to work. And that moment in 1989, the summer of 89, sent her on a 30-year battle where she lost nearly everything. She was turned into an enemy of you know, she was a pariah in her town, even though she was a fourth-generation fisherwoman. And nearly lost everything until she won a historic settlement just a couple years ago.
It's an amazing story. The Fisherman and the Dragon, Fear, Greed, and a Fight for Justice on the Gulf Coast. Kirk Wallace Johnson, thanks for joining us again on The Exchange.
Oh, it's a great honor to be here.
All right, take care.